Nous allons commencer et donc je vais passer tout de suite à l'anglais, mais je vais d'abord dire en français que c'est un très grand plaisir pour moi d'accueillir Roger Chartier dans le cadre de cette Summer School de l'EHESS. Il a eu la gentillesse d'accepter de faire cette conférence alors qu'il revient tout juste de São Paulo qu'il a atterri hier. Voilà, so I'm delighted to host Roger Chartier for this talk that is given specially for the summer school of the EHESS, for the students of the summer school. It's an open talk also for other persons. And Roger Chartier accepted to give this talk and prepared a specific talk for today, and where he would be discussing his book on the cultural origins of French Revolution, since our topic in the summer school is about the concept, rethinking the concept of revolution. So Roger Chartier, I know I don't need to introduce him, but still I will, of course. He's a very famous historian, historian of publishing, historian of reading. He initiated a whole series of books on the history of publishing in France. And he's the author of many, many books that I cannot quote all. I would just mention again this book on cultural origins of French Revolution that was translated with Duke University Press in 1991. And recently, his two last books that were translated into English, one is entitled Cardenio, Between Cervantes and Shakespeare, Story of a Lost Play. And it's about a play that we don't have any trace of, and he reconstitutes all the conditions of production of and reception of this play. And the second one is The Author and the Printer's Mind, The Author's Hand and the Printer's Mind. Both were translated with Polity Press. So Roger Chartier is a professor at École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales and at Collège de France, and he would be, and he is also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, right?
Exactly.
And so he would be giving his talk on the title he gave is "Do Books Make Revolution?"
Question mark.
Question mark, but with an S, or revolution or revolutions with a question mark. So, Roger, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Giselle. After apologizing for my clumsy English, I shall begin by indicating that this question, "Do Books Make Revolution?", was the title of the fourth chapter of a book, The Cultural Origins of French Revolution, you just quoted, I published more than 25 years ago. And I think there is some irony to come back to this book today in these amphitheaters that honor the memory of François Furet, who deeply disliked the book. Some irony thus, but also some imprudence in accepting Giselle Sapiro's invitation. In the last years, my research was devoted to the early modern period between 16th, 17th century, and not the 18th century, nor the revolution. My most recent works are about the relationship between written culture as a whole and some literary genre, particularly theatrical plays, and I worked more on Cervantes, Shakespeare, or Molière than on the philosopher. Consequently, my knowledge of the most recent books and articles on the French Revolution is limited, very limited. What struck me nevertheless was, in the recent months or weeks, a new interest for the French Revolution in France, as proved by an issue of the journal Critique in the last May, a series of review articles published in Le Monde des Livres on the last June 23rd, or a forthcoming new edition of one of the polemical books published during the bicentennial, the book by Daniel Ben Saïd, Moi, la Révolution, and the reedition will have a preface by Arlette Farge. This context, that is as much political as historiographical, led me to come back to the book I wrote in the spring of 1988, when I was the first Luigi Einaudi professor in European and international studies at Cornell University. This book was published in French in 1990, and as said Giselle, in English, translated by Lydia Cochrane, the following year, in the series Bicentennial Reflections on the French Revolution, a series which was edited by Keith Baker and Steve Kaplan for Duke University Press. Taking advantage of the bicentennial and post-bicentennial years, the book was translated into Italian, Japanese, German, Spanish, Korean, Estonian, and Portuguese. I conceived it as a reflection on the cultural origin of the French Revolution, of course it was a title, but with two caveats or two qualifications, sometimes forgotten by the critics of the books. On the one hand, I knew perfectly the weakness of the notion of origins and the Foucault's devastating criticism of what he called the chimera of origin, la chimère des origines, that annuls the radical originality of an event by supposing that it is already present before it happens. On the other hand, I was deeply convinced that the French Revolution had other origins than the cultural ones, either socioeconomic origins or intellectual origins. The intellectual origin of the events must be analyzed by Keith Baker in another book of the same series, but finally Keith didn't publish it in this form, and he published the book with Cambridge University Press in 1990 with the title Inventing the French Revolution, Essays on French Political Culture in the 18th Century France. The reception of this book was strongly divided. In France, Bronislav Bachko wrote a very interesting, favorable review in Libération. But as I said at the beginning, François Furet wrote a very negative, and I can say nasty, review in Le Nouvel Observateur. His intellectual contempt for any interpretation of the revolution that was not framed within the language of political philosophy was one reason of his condemnation. Some tensions and conflicts about the scientific politics and the election at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales were another ones. Elsewhere, the book was considered either as focusing too exclusively on cultural mutation and rupture by the historians faithful to a strictly social interpretation of the revolution, or, contradictorily, as too heavily sociological by the historians inspired by Baker and Furet, who interpreted the event as only a political one. Some found the book too idealistic, inspired by the discursive, if not linguistic, turn, and blind to social realities. Others saw it as grounded in a cultural sociology that ignored ideas, theories, doctrines. Such a reception indicated that the path was narrow before and after the bicentennial between the classic social historiography, Marxist or not, illustrated by the tradition of Mathies, Lefebvre, and Sobol's works, and on the other hand, the new historiography that used concept and lexicon of political philosophy. Steve Kaplan's book, Farewell Revolution, and particularly this volume devoted to the historian feud, 1789-1989, published in 1995, or a recent book by Michel Vauvel, who was one of the main actors of the bicentennial. His book has as a title La bataille du bicentenaire de la Révolution. These two books allow to remember, to understand how difficult it was to introduce in the fierce historical controversies between, to introduce in these fierce historical controversies a perspective focusing neither on class struggle, immediately conceived as social struggle, nor on political philosophy, but on collective beliefs, representation, and behavior. Retrospectively, the harsh opposition between the defenders of the Jacobin and Marxist historiography, as was Michel Vauvel, and the follower of Keith Baker and François Furet seems perhaps a little weird. On the one hand, Michel Vauvel's personal work had been devoted to the mutation of beliefs that characterized the process of de-Christianization and secularization before and during the revolution. On the other hand, Mona Ozou, who supported Furet's approach, has published in 1976 a superb cultural analysis of the revolutionary festivals. The political opposition about the bicentennial and the competition between Vauvel, who organized an impressive international congress at the Sorbonne in July 1989, exactly the same week we have now, and Furet, crowned as the king of the revolution, first by the Nouvel Observateur and then by the New York Times, this competition, in a sense, blocked, I thought and still deplore, a deeper and necessary reflection on the definition of what can and must be the historical intelligibility of past or contemporary events. The brutal confrontation between the two dominant historiographical approaches have hidden the necessary articulation between, on the one hand, the objective constraints and determination that produced transformation and rupture, in this case, as shown since Ernest Delabroux's canonical books, these constraints and determination were demographic, economic, and social, and on the other hand, the representation and practices of the actors themselves. It is in such a perspective I would like to inscribe this lecture with the hope that the reflection on one specific historical event, the French Revolution in the late 18th century, will be able to meet the theoretical issues raised by your own research projects or to frame comparative approaches with other historical situations. And we can begin, perhaps, with a classical problem, the relation between the event and what is before the event, between the revolution and the Enlightenment. Some critics found excessively provocative to ask, as I have done, contrary to the traditional formulation according to which the Enlightenment produced a revolution, to ask how the revolution constructed or invented the Enlightenment. This question could be answered in the different manners, because the ways and means of this retrospective construction of the Enlightenment by the revolution are many. The election to the Pantheon were the most spectacular of these devices, but also the most selective, since only two writers from the past, Voltaire and Rousseau, were welcomed in the Pantheon, received as grands hommes. All the others who were proposed at the time, Descartes, Fénelon, Buffon, Mably, were rejected by the revolutionary assemblies. Thus, those two authors, Voltaire and Rousseau, were recognized as true precursors of the revolution. This is implicit in the inscription engraved on the sarcophagus containing Voltaire's mortal remains when they were transferred to the Pantheon on July 11, 1791, in a moment of a unanimous national sentiment and an alliance between the revolution and the church, the new constitutional church. On the one side of this sarcophagus, it was possible to read, E. Voltaire combated atheists and fanatics. He demanded the right of man against the servitude of feudalism. On the other side, poet, historian, philosopher, he enlarged the human spirit and taught it that it must be free. This is similar to what Robespierre said of Rousseau in his discourse sur les rapports des idées religieuses et morales on May 7, 1794, which incidentally lashed out the materialist sect of the encyclopedist. And Robespierre was speaking about Rousseau. Among those who, in the time I speak of, stood out in the career of letters and philosophy, one man, Rousseau, by the elevation of his soul and by the grandeur of his character, showed himself worthy of the ministry as preceptor of humankind. Ha! If he had been witness to this revolution whose precursor he was, and that bore him to the Pantheon, it was done on October 12, 1793, who can doubt that his generous soul would have embraced with transport the cause of justice and equality. But what is interesting, it seems to me, is this reflection about how an event constructs its own past and its precursors. The canon was not limited to the two authors elected for the Pantheon. It also included a variety of genres, such as the anthologies or florilèges published in the almanacs and the literary journals, or works of extracts that offered selection from one author of a group of authors. Two examples, a political catechism by Véron, titled Au peuple, des vérités terribles mais indispensables, tiré de Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Mably, Rénal et de tous les philosophes amis des principes de l'égalité. Another example, a poem, Les Philosophes, who appeared in l'Almanach des Muses in 1794 and that celebrated Fontenelle, Voltaire, Diderot, Franklin, and Rousseau. In political celebration multiplied in the year two of the Republic, busts, statues of the philosophers and the martyr for liberty also figured in this retrospective quest for legitimacy. An example in Roar in Picardy, a ceremonial honored Voltaire, Rousseau, Buffon, Franklin, Marat, and Le Pelletier de Saint-Farchaud, which were present in the form of busts, and they were praised by sung in civic couplets. And the same was true, it seems to me, for a number of widely circulated printed objects as the decks of cards. In the year two, the printer Gaillon replaced the kings of the cards by the philosopher Voltaire and Rousseau, but also we need the four kings, Molière and La Fontaine. But also the revolutionary almanacs, the ABCs, the catechism were used for the retrospective construction of the precursor of the rupture. The alphabet des sans-culottes in the year two, premier élément d'éducation républicaine, offered the following exchange. Question, who are the men who by their writings prepared the revolution? Answer, Helvétius, Mably, Rousseau, Voltaire, and Franklin. How do you call this, how do you call these great men? Philosophers. What does that word mean? Wise men, friends of humanity. In one sense, then, it was the revolution that made the books, and not the other way around, since it was the revolution that gave a programmatic meaning to certain works constituted after the fact as its origin. Obviously, my proposition in the book was not intended as a denial of the existence of the Enlightenment as a major historical event. Rather, it was aimed at understanding how the revolutionary erected this pantheon of author and corpus and books and idea into which they read an anticipation and the legitimation of that event. The operation supposes simultaneously that the selected among all the possible authors we have seen for the Pantheon and writing, and that they reduced to a unity an extreme diversity of opinion and positions. Using a broad variety, as I said, of oratorical, ceremonial, iconographic, textual devices, the revolutionaries worked to transform a plural ideological heritage into a necessarily unified political genealogy. Two sorts of remarks arose regarding how the revolution reworked the Enlightenment. First, some scholars have investigated the multiple differentiations that had fragmented the world and the world of the Enlightenment. A series of oppositions was stressed between radical utopian thinker or radical Enlightenment versus practical reformer. You can find this in the classical work by Franco Venturi or more recently by Jonathan Israel. Or opposition between the high Enlightenment and the low life of literature, Robert Danton. Or the opposition between the enlightened reformed enlightened but in for reform of the institution and administration of the provincial elites versus the men of letters of the capital of Paris, Daniel Roche, or the generation of the encyclopedist versus the prophet philosopher of the 1780s, as stressed by Vincenzo Ferrone, who belonged to the tradition of Franco Venturi, Settecento Riformatore. Or finally, the opposition between an intellectual enlightenment versus the popular non-intellectual enlightenment as proposed by Aram Vartanian. Such differences of position and stance, of generation, of epistemological model depicted a more fractured and a more diverse reality than had long been proposed when the Enlightenment was equated with a body of stable, commonly shared proposition. Second, other scholars have reflected on how the French Revolution related to history. A paradox underlies that relation, because although that event can be thought of as a rupture that set off something new, an absolute beginning, the year one of the Republic, it is also written off in reference to a past that justified and shaped it. In that sense, the relation of the Revolution to the Enlightenment cannot be separated from the relation of the Revolution to antiquity, a topic made famous by Marx. But the reconstruction of an inspiring or exemplary past located in Greece or Rome was not without tensions and conflicts, just as the Spartan model and the Roman model were far from being unanimously accepted. The Enlightenment was not the same for everyone who took part in the revolution. As several German historians have suggested, Thomas Schleich, Rolf Reichardt, and Jürgen Lüsebrink, each of the various revolutionary parties constructed its own Enlightenment, whence the difference between the Voltairean and the Rousseauistic time for the Pantheonization, or the multiple opposition which used different references for justifying their own perspective and project. Naturally, this approach touches the heart of any history of the cultural origin of the French revolutions. Several things are involved here. First, broadening the usual questioner of intellectual history to take into account not only conceptual production, but also, and perhaps especially, collective representations and forms of beliefs. Next, restoring to institutions and forms of sociability their unique dynamism rather than considering them as simply accepting or rejecting ideas and theories. Finally, refusing to reduce non-discursive practices to the discourse that, in a variety of ways, were intended to legitimate, condemn, represent, control, prescribe, proscribe, or organize them. By doing this, such a perspective also aims at resisting two operations frequent in the historiography of the French Revolution and its origin, and perhaps in other historiographies for other revolutions. On the one hand, deducing practices from thoughts, thoughts from readings, and reading from text. On the other hand, translating social practices or institutional practices in terms of an explicit ideology. The first of these two operations, deduction, lends support to the traditional view that tied the revolutionary rupture to a wider and wider dissemination of philosophical ideas. When this view, very classical, was shifted from the great classics of the Enlightenment to the text that the 18th century book trade called Livres philosophiques, philosophical books, and which are not Rousseau or Voltaire, but critical pamphlets, libels, scandal-mongering chronicles, anti-clerical satires, pornographic works. It provided Robert Danton, and with him Raymond Burne, who just died recently, with a basis for evaluating, I quote Danton, the subversive violence of clandestine literature. Thanks to the circulation of printed works, seditious texts depicting the despotic corruption of the monarchy or the depraved morals of the court, this circulation engendered a change in thought and, more deeply, in representation, and henceforth detached the reader from the old loyalties to the king, to the aristocracy, to the state, to the church. There is a quotation by Danton which tried to assemble the traditional view of the impact of the philosophy in a traditional, classical, intellectual meaning, and the circulation of the livre philosophique. We were not immediately philosophical, but were with the subversive and critical content. I quote, "The corrosion operated in two ways, at the level of ideas. The writing of Voltaire and D'Holbach openly denounced the falsities of the systems of orthodoxy that supported the church and the crown. At the level of representation, the pamphlets and scandal-mongering chronicles desacralized by throwing mud on the monarchy and all the values that structure its political rationality." Still, in the second perspective, which tried to challenge a more classical and strictly intellectual one, the perspective developed in many books by Robert Danton, remains something of the connection between the subversion contained in the text and the revolution warming its way into people's mind. And if we think like this, in this perspective, we risk to destroy the specificity of the mechanism by which books, pamphlets, labels acquired meaning. Those mechanisms depended in part on the way the texts themselves organized a plurality of ways they could be read and understood. This was the case, for example, with the pornographic pamphlets exposing Marie Antoinette's dissolute sexuality. These works operated on several levels of horizon of expectation, involving the convention of erotic or pornographic literature, devices for producing effects taken as true, as if Marie Antoinette was really the way she was described in these pamphlets, but also they could be read within the intrigue of the court politics and had a denunciatory rhetoric, which was not necessarily taken at a face value, but which was producing the corrosion that evoked by Robert Danton. In this sense, the intelligibility of the clandestine literature depended on the horizon of expectation or reception it encountered. Hence, the hypothesis that some forms of detachment from the sovereign, the monarchy, the old order, should be understood not necessarily as a result of the circulation of the philosophical book, but as a condition for their success. Danton writes, I quote, sedition was hatching. It was instilled in people's mind. We know for certain that it was communicated by a formidable instrument, the book. Why should we not think that the sedition was already present and inhibited actions, emotions, and thoughts that owed nothing to reading the written word in any form? It seems to me that this perspective, either in relation with the classical view of the Enlightenment leading to the revolution, or in the view according to which the main emphasis has to put on the circulation of seditious pamphlets and libels, keep something of a possible illusion of readers, as are the historian and their readers, as if the books were read in a univocal form, and as if the action, the detachment, the representation was a consequence, was a product of this reading of this text. And it's the reason why it seems to me, in this context of discussion and for many of the projects I have read, the work by Arlette Farge are very important. In one of her books, Dire et Maldire, she's looking at the mauvais propos, mauvais discours, that is to say critical words, sentences, which were aimed at the king and that interested both the police spies in Paris in the 18th century and the writer of sensational news sheets. Arlette Farge states conclusively in this book, I quote, popular opinion did not emerge from the cumulative reading of pamphlets and placards. It was not unilinear and did not base arguments on the sum total of what it read. And thus she challenged the interpretation that saw the increase in seditious writing in the last two or three decades of the Ancien Régime as a matrix for a desacralization of the monarchy that opened the way to radical and universal criticism. For her, statements of disapproval or hatred of the sovereign, attacks on his acts, expression of a desire to kill the king himself, did not arise from the flourishing clandestine literature. Nor did they start with Damiens' attempt to assassinate Louis XV, which, rather than unleashing a proliferation of regicide discourse, persuaded the authorities of the reality of Jansenist or Jesuit plots and set them in hot pursuit of such literature. So there is an effect of the source, more than perhaps a transformation of the actual reality. For Arlette Farge, I quote again, the failed murder of Louis XV in 1757, and ready-made public opinion. It tells us more about the monarchy's reaction than about new and original turn of popular thought. That remark lends support to a second idea, the symbolic and affective disinvestment that transformed relation with authority when it was deprived of all transcendence, was manifested but not caused by the wide diffusion, even the very wide diffusion, of philosophical books. The erosion of the founding myths of the monarchy, the desacralization of royal symbols, the distancing of the person of the king formed a body of representation that was already there, ready made, ready to welcome the radical denunciation of the subversive literature of the 1770s and 1780s. So this is the first approach and critique of this approach in terms of the deduction of practice from ideas and ideas from your books and from the reading of these books. The second operation I mentioned, that is to say to translate into an explicit ideology some social functionings of forms of sociability or institution, seems to me challenged and must be challenged. An exemplary illustration of this sort of approach, which is not deduction but translation, is a thesis, a famous thesis of Augustin Cochin, reworked by François Furet, according to which the functioning of the Société de Pensée, the Freemasonry, lodges, or many other clubs and society in this sense of the 18th century, to translate this functioning during the 18th century as it was Jacobin. Independent of the intention of the Masonic lodges and this Société de Pensée, independent of the particularity of the social recruitment, according to Cochin, their egalitarian practice aimed at producing consensus and eliminating dissent was seen as constituting the matrix of the pure democracy and the terrorist practice of Jacobinism, both in the clubs and the revolutionary government. This thesis detaches individual wills, detaches from individual wills and consciences the significance of the social machinery, according to Cochin's expression, at work in these forms of sociability, and particularly the Masonic lodges. This, for Cochin, which was referring to Durkheim, was a way to comprehend democracy in the same way that Republican sociology comprehends religion, a social fact whose meaning cannot be reduced to the explicit statement it produces, which indeed masks the way it really works. Hence, the genealogy of the democratic ideology, whose terrorist potential is to be identified on the practical level in the peaceful societies of the Enlightenment. Social operations, social practices, social functioning thus find their translation in the form of a theory, in this case, the theory of Jacobinism and the prefiguration of the terror. This thesis, although intellectually powerful, fails to take adequate account of the actual practice of the Masonic lodges in first instance. For one thing, as Margaret Jacob has stressed, they could hardly have been said to be characterized by the exercise of direct democracy. Quite the contrary, particularly in France, ancien regime practices continue to predominate in the functioning of the lodges. Hereditary transfer of the prestigious offices, power of the dignitaries, social exclusiveness that prohibited fraternizing within Masonic circles with people who were not one's own sort in the social world at large, and so on. So it was clearly a discrepancy between how the lodges really functioned and this location by Cochin and after Furet of the pure democratic ideal leading to the impossibility to accept the dissent, which was a prefiguration of the terror. For another thing, if the social mechanisms proper to the Masonry in and on and of themselves follow the democratic, revolutionary, and terrorist logic, how are we to account for the gap between the universality of Freemasonry from England to Brazil or America and the exceptional nature of French Jacobinism? Margaret Jacob said also, if the Masonic lodges were the seedbeds of Jacobinism, then why did they not spawn it in Philadelphia in 1780 or in Brussels and Amsterdam in the 1790s? Giving central importance to relation between practice and discourse, and there are many formulations in your project, theory and practice, discourse and practice, ideas and practice, giving central importance to the relation between practice and discourse, between non-discursive systems and enunciative facts, to quote Foucault in The Archaeology of Knowledge, leads to a shift of emphasis to detachment not expressed in discourse, or at least not in explanatory, justificative discourse, to the relative independence of systems of representation from the circulation of text, and to the construction of a political culture built on ordinary experiences and daily conflict. Putting the question of the cultural origin of the French Revolution in these terms does not imply that its causes were entirely, uniquely, of a cultural sort. Such an approach tries to understand why, at a given moment in the trajectory of the Ancien Régime, the swift, radical, brutal destruction of the foundation of the old order became so easily intelligible, immediate, decipherable, and so broadly accepted. It was a topic for Tocqueville, why in some weeks of July 1789, all this old order, the principle founding this old order, was crumbled and destroyed and accepted as destroyed. To draw up an inventory of changes in representation and sensitivity that made that break conceivable is not to say that those changes produced that break. Asking that sort of question of cultural history does not entail subjecting the set of problems connected with the origin of the French Revolution to the linguistic turn and to the semiological challenge or semiotic challenge. That perspective, of course brilliantly illustrated by Keith Baker, rests on two suppositions, and this perspective is not mine and was not the perspective of the book, even if some critics have read the book in this light. This perspective, particularly subtly developed by Keith Baker, supposes first that the social interests are in no way external or prior to discourse, and secondly, that you cannot draw a distinction between discursive and non-discursive practices. This position, which reflects the most radical formulation of the linguistic turn and apply them to intellectual history, seems to me unacceptable. In fact, the processes by which discourse constructs interests or events are themselves socially determined and are limited in varying degree by the linguistic, conceptual, material resources available to their producers. Thus, those processes refer to objective social properties external to discourse that are characteristics of each of the groups, community, and classes that make up the social world. What is more, the logic at work in discursive production should not be confused with the logic that commands the forms of social action. There is a radical difference between the lettered, logocentric, hermeneutic rationality that organizes the production of discourse and the other forms of rationality informing all other regimes of practice. You can frame this opposition with the opposition between the scholastic logic and the practical sense in Pierre Bourdieu's work. If, like Baker, we fail to make this distinction, we are led to inscribe the ongoing event within a pre-existing discourse. In the French Revolution's choice of one political language, the language of general sovereignty, over another, for example, the language of representation of social interest. For Keith Baker, the terror was ineluctable. Virtually present in the constitutional decisions of the autumn of 1789, and before that date, in the theory of the general will elaborated by Rousseau, by Mably, and by the most radical propagandists in the parliament. The game was already over when the National Assembly, I quote Baker, was opting for the language of political will rather than of social reason, of unity rather than of difference, of civic virtue rather than of commerce, of absolute sovereignty rather than of government limited by rights of man, which is to say that in the long run, it was opting for the terror. In this perspective, and we can come back to the devastating criticism by Foucault of the notion of origin, the revolution was written even before it happened. I quote, "The revolutionary script was invented from within the political culture of the absolute monarchy, insofar as it was wholly contained in one of the forms of political discourse developed under absolutism." For two reasons, this thesis, which fits the terror into the illiberalism of 1789 and fits that illiberalism into the language of Rousseau, is open to criticism, it seems to me. First, it denies the event any radicality, since the event is already present in discourse before it happens. And it deprives the event of any dynamism, since what Maurice Aguilon called the empirical weight of contingent reality is refused a role. Second, it makes the historian interpretation share the illusion of 1789 and 1793. Then, certitude about the absolute efficacy of the political, believed capable of recasting the body politic, refounding society, regenerating the individual, inspired absolute confidence in the power of idea, the performative role of words, and the role of individual. But must that belief mean that the history of the French Revolution has to be written in the language of the event? And it was something ironic and paradoxical in this perspective, because the same historian who were condemning some of the Jacobin enthusiasm of the old Jacobin and Marxist tradition, which share the hopes and lexicon of the actors, the same who condemned this perspective for its lack of distance from the revolution, also submitted the intelligibility of the event to the historical consciousness of the contemporaries. It seems to me that the question of the origin of 1789 necessarily sends us in another direction toward an elucidation of the determinations that govern the intentions, choices, and discourses of individuals, whether or not they are conscious of such a process. The hypothesis that inscribes the French Revolution within the Ancien Régime can be understood in quite different terms. Denis Richet provides a basic notion for such a different approach. And I quote a book by Richet, L'Esprit des Institutions. "The more absolutism brought in reinforcements, the weaker it got. Hence, the weakening of the Ancien Régime, political, social, cultural, should be sought in the very mechanism that seems to ensure its power. For Richet, the definition of the raison d'état, the reason of state, and the development, à la Tocqueville, of a centralized administration laid the foundation for the power of absolutism, but at the same time were also the reason for its weakness, because it set a current body of the king's subjects against him." This model of interpretation permits us to see how the separation organized by the state himself between the reason of state, the only check on the actions of the prince, and moral or religious judgments relegated to the private or religious conscience of individuals was eventually turned against the prince, now judged, criticized, condemned in the name of criteria that had been expelled from the political domain by the concept of the raison d'état. This is the sense in which one can see, the title of a chapter in Korselec, Critique and Crisis. The political structure of absolutism is a precondition of the Enlightenment. The issue is not so much to postulate that revolutionary principles and practices were invented in the context of the absolute monarchy, as to understand how the cultural mutation that made the revolution rupture conceivable was operating. This emphasis on the conceptual and social construction of public space, that is to say, this space which can use against the reason of state the values or beliefs that the reason of state are relegated in the sphere of the privacy. This emphasis gave authority to the famous, unavoidable, Habermas structural transformation of the public sphere. To many people, as you know, and particularly I remember an article by Danton in the New York Review of Books, the work by Habermas has very little relevance for the analysis of the 18th century phenomena, because mainly, of course, the book was a critique of today's society and the threats against the public sphere. The weakness of the book is perhaps made all the more evident because Habermas reintroduced the concept of the bourgeoisie as a category for defining the public sphere, just when this category, the bourgeoisie, has been repudiated either in the description of the Enlightenment, detached from this specific social class, or in the interpretation of the French Revolution itself. One might make the same remark regarding a possible reading of Korselec, Critique and Crisis, because the subtitle of the book is Ein Studie zur Pathogenese der bürgerlichen Welt, and the notion of the bourgeois world, of the bourgeois elite, is essential in this book. And it was an irony in Colin Jones' remark when he was speaking about the return of the banished bourgeoisie, thanks to the reading by the historian of Korselec. But it seems to me that beyond this discussion about this category, what is important by the rereading of Habermas' book is the proposition of an alternative model of comprehension, of understanding of this machinery described by Cochin and Furet. Because the book allows, with some discrepancy, a return to one of the two texts by Kant I would like to use for the conclusion. A return first to Was ist Aufklärung, what is enlightenment, and which is stressing an articulation between the public and the particular, and focusing on the construction of the public sphere as defined as the users of the public use of the reason by private individual. The difference being, of course, that in the case of Habermas' book, this public use of the reason by private individuals is located in the different forms of sociabilities of the 18th century, the salon, the clubs, the society, the literary society, the Masonic lodges, periodicals, whereas in Kant, the issues is located in the circulation of the written word. The public use of the reason by private individual is a use made by someone who read and who write, exchange opinions, project reforms about the social world or any of the institution. And this seems to me an interesting possibility opened by Habermas' book, or at least the way to which he was read by the historian. Conclusion, this retrospective reflection on the origin of the French Revolution, both the historical phenomena and a particular book, should perhaps enable us to pose a question which seems to me central. How are we to make the connection between the description of contemporaries' historical consciousness, obsessed as they were in 1789 by the certainty of inaugurating something absolutely new, absolute rupture with the old, how to connect this description of the perception of the contemporary with the identification of the unrecognized determination that led those same people to make a history perhaps different from the one they thought they were making. We need to restore the radicality of the emerging event, but we also need to rediscover the unrealized paradoxical continuities that inscribe that event within the long history of the monarchy and the Ancien Régime society. And after reading the different research projects proposed for this summer school, it seems to me that this question can be related with the different issues raised by this project. The first, and in two manners, perhaps, there is a relation between the project and this lecture of the works of the relationship between Enlightenment and the French Revolution. The first way would be to analyze how the French Revolution dealt with topics and issues that you raised for other times and other places. For example, security and surveillance, either opposed to or taken as a condition of the protection and the defense of rights, and also opposed to or condition of a transparent democracy. Or second, the tension existing between different forms of violence and the hope with the revolution, revolutionary event, either in perpetual peace, as said Kant, or in a civilized society in the sense proposed by Norbert Elias, that is to say, the restraint and constraint upon the users of violence. Or third, the relationship between the revolutionary event and the transformation of the medias, or the reformation of the reform of the educational system. Or finally, the contrast between the fundamental role of women in the course of events and their exclusion from political rights and political activism. All these issues were central in the revolutionary process of the late 18th century. They are central in several of the research projects you have proposed, and they were also central in the memories of the event, the French Revolution, in the 19th century politics, from 1848 to the Commune, or in the construction of precursor by the Russian and Chinese Revolution, that is to say a reference to the French one. Such an observation raises, I think, the question of the relevance and condition of historical comparisons. A second perspective associating this lecture and your project deals, it seems to me, with shared theoretical issues or uncertainties. One of the most fundamental is how to think both the differences and the relationships existing, as I say, between ideas, theories, ideas, theory, discourse, and practices. Are all the practices linguistic, as stated by the linguistic term, or must we stress, I have suggested, the irreducibility of practical sense to scholastic logic? Another issue is rooted in the distance existing between the representation of the historical actors who thought of their experience as a radical rupture in a revolutionary time, and the deep continuities not perceived by them, but and that made their own perception as illusions. The discussion also I found about the concept of agency, I quite never use, can be located in such a tension. On the one hand, this concept, so popular today, allows to understand the different modalities of strategies consciously developed by gender, classes, communities, individuals. And in this sense, the concept of agency belongs to the reappraisal of collective intentions, collective projects, collective strategies that were defining a form of social micro-history on the side of the specific modality of consciousness and strategies. But as you know, on the other hand, the concept of agencies endows non-humans with the capacity to act, to produce effects, and in this case, without any form of intentionality. It had transformed, with this second perspective, both the anthropological approach, for example, in the book of my colleague Philippe Descola, or the sociology of knowledge in Bruno Latour's perspective. Perhaps it's the advantage of this concept to be quite contradictory, but it seems to me we have to elucidate the use of agency divided between the conscious strategy and used in a form of social microhistory and the users detached from human intentionality when it is used to speak about the agency of the microbe, of the scientific instruments, or of the nature itself. Last but not least, the emphasis on plural memories of the events obliges us to think, after Koselleck, about the relationships between the temporal experiences of the individual and the writing of history. The different regimes of historicity governed, indeed, as much the perception of times, the uniqueness of the event, the repetition of the same phenomenon, the knowledge of what is beyond personal experience, and the different forms of historical narration in the past or the narration we are writing ourselves, attached either to what is singular in a collective process, or conversely, to what is socially framed and shared in any personal experience. Perhaps it would be possible to find in any revolutionary situation, at least labeled as such by historians, two paradoxes. The first is a tension, as I said, between the claim for a radical discontinuity, and many of the revolutions you are dealing with has this claim. The claim in the inauguration of a new era, the claim in the foundation of a new time, a new society. And on the other hand, the construction of a corpus of precursors that can be previous events, the French Revolution for the 20th century revolution, could be prophetic author, or also transform into prophets, or could be books. Such a view can inspire, it seems to me, a comparative approach. For example, between the French Revolution enlightened and the biblical English Revolution of the 17th century, or between the French Revolution and the Marxist one in 1917 Russia. And the second and final paradox lies in this possible distance or contradiction between the outcome of the events and their deep meaning. And it's the reason why I want to quote, I would like to quote as a last text, a second text commented by Foucault. The first one was Was ist Aufklärung, what is enlightenment, 1784. But Foucault commented also on the Kant's text, The Conflict of the Faculties, the 1798, the second dissertation of this book by Kant. And what is the core of the reflection of Kant is the distinction between the meaning of the French Revolution and the French Revolution as an event. The French Revolution as an event has accumulated misery, violence, atrocity, and dissuaded to be imitated. And this cannot be for Kant the demonstration, the course of events of the ineluctable progress of the human race, which is at the core of this second dissertation. But the French Revolution is not only this course of events, this outcome of events. It's also something which is inscribed in its decipherment or expectation by all the people of all the nations of the world. That is to say, an event which urges men to give themselves a freely chosen constitution in harmony with natural law, and also to build principles which will be able to avoid any offensive war. The revolution, or more accurately, the reaction to, the reception of the event, revealed in this sense a predisposition in human nature that, I could count, permits people to hope for progress. And this is more fundamental than the course of event, the hazards of the historical situation in which this hope was manifested, but also corrupted. And it seems to me that in itself, neither the course nor the outcome of the revolution is important in such a perspective by Kant. Its importance lies in its given, in the fact to give a spectacular visibility to the virtualities underlying enlightenment in the sense of your natural constitution and a perpetual peace. Such a perspective is perhaps relevant for all revolutions that were and are the object of this summer school. But I leave to you to decide. Thank you.